Feeling bogged down by your daily grind? Not living up to your greatest potential? Then it's time to turn up the heat and get real with what truly matters. Be it family, career, wellness, spirituality, or anything else that fuels your inner flame. Join Fire It Up with CJ as this respected life coach talks to a wide range of experts and everyday people for their inspiring and unconventional ideas to help you make the most from your life. Equal parts heart warmer, cheerleader, and butt kicker, CJ Liu draws on her extensive experience in business and life coaching, along with her intuition and playful humor, to address meaningful topics with truth and irreverence. It takes just one spark to ignite a fire. Now, here's your host, CJ.
I'm CJ Liu, and you're listening to Fire It Up with CJ on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. Talk radio to spark your curiosity, illuminate your spirit, and fire you up into action right here, right now, and every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Today on Fire It Up with CJ, I have Dennis Hayes, who in 1970 was a coordinator for the first day, first Earth Day. And the founder of the Earth Day Network. The focus of today's program will be on grassroots efforts on a local level and what's working and what's not. Welcome, Dennis.
Hi, CJ. It's good to be here.
I can't even say your actual event is not awful. I'm sorry about that. Hey, guess what? I noticed that there's Hallmark cards now with Earth Day. How cool is that?
It's actually now appears on a lot of calendars, and in fact, there's a decent argument that now that we're in about 180 countries most years, it's possibly the most widely celebrated secular sort of day of observance, a holiday with a theme to it in the world.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Did you ever imagine that it would grow to this magnitude when you started?
I never imagined that there would be a second one. We knew this was a one-time event in 1970, and assumed we would then move. I actually sort of tried to kill it in 1971, because 1970 had been so spectacularly successful that we knew that 1971, in the wake of the Cambodian invasion and all sorts of other things going on, that it would be a much smaller thing, and the media would write it up as, the interest is flagging, it was a flash in the pan. But there was no way to stop it. People got into it and just kept doing it year after year.
Well, thank goodness that happened, or else you wouldn't have a little card right now, and you also wouldn't be on every calendar in the world, in 180 nations at least. So let's paint the picture of how you even came up with the idea. I mean, I know that you're at Harvard at the Kennedy School of Government. And you decided to leave, right?
Well, it's a long, complicated story with lots of roots to it that probably don't make great radio, but a couple of important ones. One, a senator from Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson, a really strong conservationist who'd been frustrated by the lack of attention that these issues had been getting, had tried for a long time to see if he could stir up some interest and came up with the idea of having an environmental teach-in, much as there had been teach-ins on the war in Vietnam and teach-ins on civil rights issues on college campuses. On a totally different route, I had become enormously estranged from much of what was going on in the world when hitchhiking around the world for 3 years trying to find the meaning of life, the traditional 19-year-old boy filled with too many hormones and too much angst, searching for his future. And in one really important night in my life, down in Namibia, I decided that the science of ecology and the ways that things interact with, cooperate with, compete with, devour, or what have you, one another inside ecosystems, had important things to say about how human communities could react in a sustainable fashion as well, and really stayed awake that whole night, got up the following morning having decided what I wanted to do with my life, which is to find ways to build human communities and societies that were founded on ecological principles. Finished up my undergraduate work, went off to the Kennedy School at Harvard, and Senator Nelson made an announcement about this environmental teach-in. I hadn't heard anything about it at Harvard, and I thought that perhaps I could get the charter to organize it since I was new there and it fit in with what I wanted to do with my life and was a way to help establish some credentials in that field. So with the arrogance of youth, I flew down to Washington, D.C. and had a courtesy meeting with the senator. It turned out that actually he didn't have anyone organizing Harvard or Cambridge or Boston or Massachusetts or much of anything else. It was an idea. He'd given a bunch of speeches on it. And he'd had a pretty good response in the mail that was now trying to figure out what the next step should be. And so we spent a couple of hours talking about different things that he might or might not do. And I went back with the charter to organize Cambridge, the various colleges and universities in that area, and got a call a couple days later inviting me to drop out and come down to Washington, D.C. and organize the United States.
And how did you go about doing that? How did you even decide? Was it easy to do that? How did you go about doing that?
Well, it turns out that it was easy to do physically, but it had implications way beyond myself. This was the first year that Harvard had the Masters in Public Policy program. They had a set of very distinguished professors, including Nobel laureates like Tom Schelling, and distinguished, you know, much of the foundation of decision theory came out of Howard Rafe and Richard Neustadt, a great presidential historian. Went off for 2 years to think about how to design this program, came up with their prototype class. It had only 12 people in it, each of whom was nominated by the president of some university. I was the nominee from Stanford. So to drop out was to take away 1/12 of their class.
Wow.
In fact, two other people dropped out with me, so I was taking away 25% of their class.
But to join you in Earth Day, these other two people, or they just dropped out as well?
Oh, no, yet another person left to go work on Clean Water Action, but those two, Andy Garling and Steve Cotton, came down to work with me on Earth Day once. So it was a period of some years before the director of the program, Dick Neustadt, could refer to me without having some profanity to comment. But in any event, went down there, and it turned out after we were assembled and we pulled in some superb organizers from different parts of the country and began to patch something together, that there really wasn't very much responsiveness initially on college campuses. It was still concerned with, as you would expect, the war and civil rights issues and other things. And we were having difficulty figuring out how to bring up this environmental issue in a way that wasn't just important but was urgent and emotional and would get people engaged. So we took a look at the mail that had gone into the senator's office, and it turned out that it was overwhelmingly from women who were sort of 25 to 35 years old, generally college-educated, generally stay-at-home moms with one or two kids, and for whom this issue really resonated. So in a sense, my contribution to the whole thing was to move the focus off of campus, where we weren't being very successful, into communities where we had this new base to work from, get some people who were really skilled organizers talking with some of these women across the country about how best to put together things, rename it from Environmental Teach-In to Earth Day, and it began just building momentum with great rapidity and ultimately engaged an estimated 20 million people.
Just like soccer, these soccer moms are mass organizers. You pick the right audience of people to help you.
It's absolutely right. In fact, for a long time, it's been 40 years now, so this is no longer true, but for a very long time, if you went around the United States and you talked to women who were members of state legislatures or who were judges or who were city council members or even members of Congress, a stunningly high proportion of them got their first political engagement on Earth Day 1970.
Isn't that fascinating? Wow, that's incredible. Well, so that was actually a major accomplishment on two fronts, isn't that? So what were your original goals of the...
interesting thing, actually, going a little bit afield. But
yeah.
There's something about the environment, though I think it is arguably more radical and far-reaching than most people understand. I mean, and end the war movement, that means bring the troops home. But to build a sustainable environment is a total redirection of the economy and the culture of a country. And yet somehow that threat isn't, or that the boldness of it is not realized very well by folks. And so women who didn't want to be involved in the anti-war movement, though they had anti-war sympathies because it could have negative implications for their husbands' jobs, for example, were entirely comfortable getting involved in this. And similarly, in many countries, including, for example, in the Soviet Union, and especially in Eastern Europe, whereas if you had a protest against communism or against state authoritarianism in general or one in favor of human rights, you would have been crushed. They were entirely comfortable, those people in power were, with having people form environmental groups and protest power plants, protest new highways, protest oil refineries. And it's, once again, a great many of the leaders of the Velvet Revolution kind of cut their teeth on environmental issues.
Interesting. So a pivot is that people's focus was elsewhere, that you could actually bring in that kind of attention. Is that what you're saying, too? Is that there was like an opening where people, it was kind of, at that time, kind of a softball. People like, okay, we can talk about the environment. Is that what you mean, because there's so much else going on?
I think be correct to say that a great many people really didn't understand what they were getting into. They were pro-environment, thinking that it was litter pickup and maybe recycle your bottles, but not that you would be making a transition away from all toxic materials, that you'd be making a transition towards sustainable agriculture, that you'd be moving aggressively into super energy efficiency and the use of renewable energy resources, and getting away from planned obsolescence and into building things for durability, sustainability. I mean, the far-reaching implications were kind of lost on some of the earlier folks, but as they came to understand the issues better, drifted right along and became more and more...
Isn't that fascinating? But I think a lot of movements are when you touch people at a very practical level, too, which is probably why that worked, you know? People, and maybe it was the trash that got them excited about it initially, and then they learned over time that there was something bigger, greater than what they even imagined. So on that note, we're going to close on the first segment. Dennis Hayes, the founder of Earth Day Network, on Fire Up with CJ on Transformation Talk Radio. Up next, what's happening on the environment movement today? Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Feeling bogged down by your daily grind? Not living up to your greatest potential? Then it's time to turn up the heat and get real with what truly matters, be it family, career, wellness, spirituality, or anything else that fuels your inner flame. Join Fire It Up with CJ as this respected life coach talks to a wide range of experts and everyday people for their inspiring and unconventional ideas to help you make the most from your life. Equal parts heartwarmer, cheerleader, and butt kicker, CJ Liu draws on her extensive experience in business and life coaching, along with her intuition and playful humor, to address meaningful topics with truth and irreverence. It takes just one spark to ignite a fire. For dates and showtimes, visit www.fireitupwithcj.com or www.transformationtalkradio.com.
Hi, in case you just joined in, I'm CJ Liu, and you're listening to Dennis Hayes, president of the Bullet Foundation in Seattle, Washington, and founder of the Earth Day Network. This segment, what's happening with the environment movement today? So, Dennis, I just think it's so fascinating the way that you got involved, and that it really was kind of a grassroots movement. I mean, that's what, at least when I've read all the articles, they view it as the modern-day environmental movement. Do you view it this way?
Sure. I mean, different people use different words in different ways. But I think to the extent that you're using them the way that I use them, I agree. There's something that goes on when the movements tend to be like geysers. You have this vast eruption of stuff, of the sort that you now see going on, for example, in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia, and it could be spreading elsewhere in the Middle East. There don't appear to be any objective conditions that are totally different now than they were 3 months ago, but something shifted and somebody, and there was this precipitating event. In that case, it was the self-immolation of a person who just couldn't handle it anymore and lit himself on fire in Tunisia, but then it just spread like we were dropping a crystal into a supersaturated solution. And something like that occurred environmentally. We had multiple crystals, the Cuyahoga catching on fire, and smog alerts, letting people know you couldn't let your kids play outside anymore because of the air pollution, and Santa Barbara oil spill and what have you. But it all accumulated and caused this vast outpouring that in that case we were able to sustain for 3 or 4 years at a pretty high level of intensity and create a context within which you could pass a Clean Air Act, a Clean Water Act, an Endangered Species Act, establish an EPA, Marine Mammal Protection Act, Environmental Education Act, on and on and on. And in the course of it, create a context within which we pretty fundamentally changed the way that America does business and introduced Americans to a new vocabulary and with it a brand new way of looking at things. And then, as always happens with these movements, whether it's an anti-war or civil rights or what's going on with pro-democracy in the Middle East, it tends to burn itself out simply through its intensity. And the trick is to get just as much accomplished as you can before those flames inevitably begin to go, and you have to rely a little bit upon whatever kind of institutions, bureaucracies, legal opportunities, what have you, you've managed to establish.
So is that the reason, would you say it's because of this burnout, you know, like any kind of movement has at a certain point of burnout? Is that what do you think is happening today? Because I really don't see anything really equivalent to Earth Day happening in other areas. But then again, I'm not also in the know of what's happening on the environmental movement. What's your assessment?
Well, we have a number of enduring institutions, of organizations that have budgets of $50 to $200 million a year that are working on a wide variety of topics, and doing so with skilled people who have maybe scientists, engineers, lawyers, economists, but that it's very different than the grassroots movement. There are some of the true grassroots groups as well. The Sierra Club, for example, with its chapters in cities across the country, can mobilize a lot of people on relatively short notice. The sense of engagement by a huge number of people who have no particular organizational affiliation but are simply motivated to get out by the substance of the issues being addressed, that constantly shifts over time. And interestingly, some of the same people move on those issues in ways that you wouldn't think were compatible with one another. They are not so much caught up in the shibboleths of left and right. It's just they are perhaps opposed to the centralization of power, whatever it may be, but people who are deeply concerned about what might be considered a very conservative agenda on taxes may also be aligned with a very liberal agenda on trying to constrain the excesses of Wall Street. And one way or the other, it's a set of issues that touch people deeply and get them out of their houses doing something.
Yeah. What do you think would have to, what would be the eruptions that, I mean, it seems like there have been many eruptions, but what do you think would, it seems like if when you paint the picture of what fueled you a while back and for 3 years, it seems like a lot of those same elements are in play now. Are they?
Sure. And in fact, if you go through those elements that precipitated the first Earth Day, despite the progress we've made in a great many fields, many things are now worse, including especially global issues, the climate change and loss of biodiversity, acidification of oceans, sorts of things. And in fact, even if you think of oil spills, the Santa Barbara oil spill, which just galvanized the nation because of this gooey black stuff coming up on these pristine sort of elite beaches in a very well-to-do community. That spilled about 200,000 gallons of oil. The recent Gulf of Mexico spill was 200 million gallons of oil, 1,000 times more. So, and it did not produce the same kind of galvanic response, except we had a lot of media attention, and in fact, we were able to get a camera down there and watch that stuff bubble out. A great many of us just spend much more time watching oil bubble out of a well 3 miles underneath the ocean than we ever thought that we would. But it didn't have that same kind of impact that caused the vast majority of Congress to begin to act on something that they hadn't acted on before. And the reforms that came out of the Gulf spill were, in my view, exceedingly modest. So
what's missing? I mean, is it just you? Do we need to have another Dennis Hayes organize everyone and get the moms involved? I mean, what's missing? Why, you know, there are issues that are just as important and grave in some ways than before. What's missing?
If I knew, I probably would be doing my best to compensate for it. But let me throw out a couple of thoughts at least.
Okay.
One is that we've had such a remarkable run of bad news for so long that people do not want to hear about threats and tend to discount it. If anybody gives you any reason to think that it may be an error, even if it's backed by the most distinguished scientific groups in the world, you know, the National Academy of Sciences versus Glenn Beck, it's pretty easy for me to make a choice, but people really don't want to hear more bad news. Mm-hmm. Second, there's a deep distrust of the response. I mean, people have gotten excited about one thing or another repeatedly over the years, only to be really disappointed with what's happened in the end. And it's also happened with regard to a great many politicians on the left and the right who've excited a base and then left them deeply disappointed later. And so to arouse people to get out, you have to have people who are prepared to hope, and it's hard to generate hope. On the other side of that is we now have, as has been demonstrated pretty well in much of the Middle East, a whole series of social networking tools that should make this kind of thing much easier if you do have the necessary precipitating events. I mean, for us to communicate with our people back in 1970, for each address we had to print out a mental plate and put it in an addressograph machine and hand crank it. Each plate went against each envelope and then, you know, put postage on each envelope and stuff in a newsletter and send it out. 5 days later, people would read it. The difference between that and instant messages and all of the other networking, Facebook, MySpace, Twitter kinds of approaches makes instantaneous communication with very large numbers of people so easy that now if you can get all the elements in shape, I think you can, in theory, be able to organize something pretty spectacular. But thus far, we've not had the genius and the set of opportunities to get that accomplished. If I could throw in one more thought, my hunch is the next really big thing is perhaps not going to be a protest against something that's unfortunate, but a demand for something that is truly excellent. So instead of protesting climate change, it will be promoting solar energy or something that people really organize around that is a positive vision for the future as opposed to despair over another calamity.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I noticed, too, about the difference between these two is that, you know, in the case, and maybe it was out of ignorance, right, or just, you know, not knowing how big it, what people started and how big it was going to be, the moms just thinking it was about picking up trash, and it was actually something much grander and bigger. In some ways, it's almost taking smaller steps, maybe, to a bigger, you know, to a bigger step, agreeing on something conceptually and then moving on something grander. I don't know. I mean, I'm just listening to the parallels of the two situations, and it seems like that may be a difference between the responses today and the responses in the past. Who knows? I want to hear your response. I would like to hear your response to that, and I need to end segment two. So, coordinator of the first Earth Day in 1970, Dennis Hayes, on Fired Up with CJ on Transformation Talk Radio. Up next, we're going to hear more from Dennis about what's happening in the environmental movement. If you want to know more about Dennis or listen to our other fabulous shows, check it out with www.fireitupwithcj.com.
Bogged down by your daily grind, not living up to your greatest potential? Then it's time to turn up the heat and get real with what truly matters, be it family, career, wellness, spirituality, or anything else that fuels your inner flame. Join Fire It Up with CJ as this respected life coach talks to a wide range of experts and everyday people for their inspiring and unconventional ideas to help you make the most from your life. Equal parts heart warmer, cheerleader, and butt kicker, CJ Liu draws on her extensive experience in business and life coaching, along with her intuition and playful humor, to address meaningful topics with truth and irreverence. It takes just one spark to ignite a fire. For dates and showtimes, visit www.fireitupwithcj.com or www.transformationtalkradio.com.
Ladies, are you living an inspired life? Do you yearn for a more passionate, dream-filled life? Here's Linda Joy, founder of Aspire Magazine, and she has a gift for you.
Aspire has launched its Mission to Inspire initiative with a commitment to give away 100,000 one-year digital subscriptions to women around the globe. Every subscription comes with a multitude of free gifts from our team inspiration partners.
To claim it all, go to AspireMag.net today. No purchase necessary. And live an inspired life.
Now is the perfect time to learn Tai Chi and Qigong. These ancient Chinese healing arts, also called mind-body practice, are simple to learn, clinically proven to be effective, and can be practiced by anyone, anywhere, at any time. For 10 years, the Institute of Integral Qigong and Tai Chi has been a respected leader in mind-body practice training. Visit IIQTC.org. Empower yourself, empower others. Visit IIQTC.org for more information on mind body practice. IIQTC.org.
Are you feeling stuck? Do you want to be free from fears and doubts and finally feel good about yourself, but you just don't know how to get there? Dr. Schaub's Accelerated Breakthrough Program provides you with the tools and solutions to go beyond your limitations and achieve self-empowered confidence. Call for your free phone consultation at 866-903-MIND. Visit CellularWisdom.com. That's CellularWisdom.com.
CJ Liu, and you're listening to Fired Up with CJ on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. This segment on Fired Up with CJ, Dennis Hayes, the coordinator of the first Earth Day in 1970. We're going to be also talking about what we can do at a local level to protect the planet. But before you begin, I want to finish up with the conversation we had during segment two about, you know, what the difference is from the past environmental movement and today, and why things we can't seem to ignite the same type of action. I made a big comment before, which is that, you know, in looking at the parallels between the movement that you had in the 1970s and today, it seems like one of the things is just starting off small and connecting with people with issues that, you know, they can really wrap their arms around. I don't know. What do you think? Is that a legitimate...
I think so. I put a little bit more nuance into it, but I think it's
okay,
at
sure.
the core of something important. I mean, we had in 1970 a number of things that were pretty locally oriented. So the groups, many of them were fighting a freeway that was going to be plowing through their neighborhood. So it was an intensely mm-hmm. local issue. Several of them had sort of lifestyle concerns and were trying to get people to lead a healthier and more organic sort of existence, and recycling was a really big issue. at the same time, coming out of the 1960s, there was a focus upon big, broad national policy issues as a legitimate thing to be addressed by popular uprisings. I mean, if you want to end a war, there's typically not very much you can do in your backyard or your neighborhood to end it. You've got to get the right vote out of Washington, D.C. If you're trying to advance racial justice, it's, you know, that was not being done within the individual states, and there was a need for a federal action that would stop, particularly in some of the most segregated states, the actions that had been there ever since the Civil War. So people were comfortable as part of the environmental movement, in addition to having these lifestyle and local concerns, to say we also need to have a federal Clean Air Act, because the local community just doesn't have the leverage to stop this polluting power plant, this polluting paper mill, this polluting what have you. So it had those multiple kinds of dimensions to it. Today, there is this great distrust of folks who are out there somehow doing things for you. There was a time when, if you were a member of Congress, you were pressing the flesh. You had to go around place after place after place. America was a sufficiently small country compared to today that you knew your public leaders. You at least met them with some degree of regularity. And now, mostly you're familiar with their television images and the carefully packaged advertisements that try to convey a message that sometimes isn't entirely in accord with reality. They characterize what is in a piece of legislation, and in fact your experience with it is very, very different. And out of all of that distrust, and in particular among the younger kids who are generally the fire behind any important public change, almost fed up with that, they would prefer to go out and do something with their hands that brings about a concrete result. And so there's an awful lot of service orientation now, and somewhat less political engagement from this upcoming generation. And I think those two are not incompatible, and you can do both, but there's going to be an emphasis for a while, I think, upon stuff that you do and accomplish by yourself, which is one of the reasons, and maybe the key reason, why around the world right now the Earth Day Network is pushing for what we're calling the Billion Acts of Green. Before we have the Rio Earth Summit in 2012 down in Brazil, we're trying to get a billion people around the planet to make various kinds of commitments in their own lives. It's relatively new, but I think we've got, the last time I went on the act, something approaching 60 million people have now made commitments and pushing toward a billion. Some of these are relatively modest. And there are people who are saying, I'm going to take the bus to work 4 days a week. A nice thing to do, but it's not going to save the planet. But, you know, a billion people taking the bus to work 4 days a week is an enormous impact.
That would make a difference. And give me some other examples of ones that are on there, other commitments.
Oh, they're everything from retrofitting a school with super efficient light bulbs to getting teachers taking their students out on a field trip to expose them to all kinds of different things, from salmon hatcheries on through to organic gardening. It's people going out on tree planting campaigns, and some of those strategic targeted tree planting campaigns in places where bad forestry practices have left something of a moonscape behind. But it's a great opportunity for creativity, for thinking of something that you are going to do yourself or with your family or with your classmates that will have some major sort of impact.
That's a great idea. So how would I find out, where would I see the list of these billion ideas? Is it on the Earth Day Foundation website, or where? And if I wanted to make a commitment similarly, what would I do?
Well, if you go to the Earth Day Network, which is www.earthday.net, over on the side of the screen, there's Billion Acts of Green in a box. If you punch that box, then all of the stuff comes up. Or if you simply Google Billion Acts of Green, the first thing that pops up in the search engine will be that page, and you can go to it directly.
Oh, that's
fantastic. It gives you a chance to put in what you're doing. We are now designing some metrics so that we'll be able to sort out what all of these different acts actually amount to, and get some sense, hopefully by a year from now, as to how much energy has been saved, how much water has been saved, how many trees have been planted, on and on.
So you said earlier that your hope is that, and I think that's a really interesting observation, that the younger people are the ones who fuel a lot of these movements, and they are probably cynical. I mean, they're cynical and don't have a lot of trust in politicians, and so they're more apt to just do things on their own, where they know that they have control over the situation and they can actually do something. And you said that, you know, these things that hopefully they'll move from doing the service orientation and into doing something more political over time. What would that look like? What would you imagine that look like?
Well, it can take a lot of different forms. And again, I think one of the important things is to not move from the personal to the political, but to keep the personal going even as you move into the political. The whole lesson of everything from Mahatma Gandhi's approach in India to every organized religion, which tries to change behavior at the same time they try to change broader things in society. Mm-hmm. But the kinds of things that I'm thinking of would be in states that have a referenda, putting together something that if your state legislature is being unresponsive to the desires to move toward a sustainable future, you actually gather, propose an initiative, gather the necessary signatures, and run a successful campaign to have people power that asserts it. And we've seen a lot of that in California and Oregon and Washington. And there are opportunities in other states to do, many other states to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. It involves not just electing candidates to office, but monitoring those candidates. And when they come home, if you've been disappointed in them, making sure that you don't just show up at their meetings and ask them tough questions, but that you organize 200 people to show up at their meetings and ask questions. I mean, some of the most vibrant organizing that's going on today, somewhat to my surprise and occasionally, frequently to my chagrin, is by the Tea Party, who are a relatively small number of Americans with a disproportionate impact because they show up. They do the hard work. That's how democracy is supposed to function.
Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting and true, right? I mean, they are organized and they're making stuff happen, for better or worse. And you're right, they have a disproportionate voice. And it's just a matter of organizing, isn't it? We need you to organize this again, Dennis, please.
Well,
we need to be organized.
They also have the advantage of having some very deep pockets behind them, of at times being pretty much aligned with the economic interests of people they may not even be particularly affectionate toward, and having the full-throated support of Fox News and the Wall Street Journal and some other organs behind them. Where these purported news organizations really act as political organizers and carry the message of the day on as though it's news. The left, and this isn't the way that it's supposed to be, but we're getting sufficiently crushed that I think the left is going to have to try to figure out some ways to get some of their own vehicles out there as well. Perhaps being things that are internet-based and do not depend upon having a Rupert Murdoch's endorsement, but rather ability, much as they did recently in the Middle East, or as MoveOn did in the United States, to build an independent movement that is on an exceedingly slender economic thread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be interesting to see what that would look like. And it would be, you know, we know it works, right? Better or worse.
In fact, your husband is one of the leading theorists in this.
Wait, I'm sorry, say that again?
I was saying you happen to be married to one of the leading theorists on how to get this to happen.
I know. I was thinking, I better go talk to my husband and say, hey, we need to be thinking more about this. I'll tell him that you said that. He'll be happy. All right, so Dennis Hayes, who's responsible for expanding Earth Day Network to 180 nations on Fired Up with CJ and Transformation Talk Radio. Up next, more on some of the great work that Dennis has been doing at the Bullitt Foundation. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Feeling bogged down by your daily grind? Not living up to your greatest potential? Then it's time to turn up the heat and get real with what truly matters, be it family, career, wellness, spirituality, or anything else that fuels your inner flame. Join Fire It Up with CJ as this respected life coach talks to a wide range of experts and everyday people for their inspiring and unconventional ideas to help you make the most from your life. equal parts heart warmer, cheerleader, and butt kicker, CJ Liu draws on her extensive experience in business and life coaching, along with her intuition and playful humor, to address meaningful topics with truth and irreverence. It takes just one spark to ignite a fire. For dates and showtimes, visit www.fireitupwithcj.com or www.transformationtalkradio.com.
Are you tired of being tired? Hi, I'm Mary Jane Mack. Did you know the adrenal glands, the workhorse of the body? They are the means by which you position yourself in life for whatever comes your way. Tiny but mighty, producing hormones the body uses to promote energy and vitality. These adrenals determine how you respond to stress, and when depleted, the body loses its ability to function powerfully when we need it most. The much-needed adrenaline or epinephrine is not available for emergency situations. Cortisone and cortisol, the longer-acting anti-stress adrenal hormones, can also become depleted due to the pace of our everyday lives. We overwork and undernutrition our most powerful ally that helps us to live the lives we desire. With CRA, we are able to determine the optimum function of the adrenals and put your system back in balance. Contact us today to feel powerfully energized at 888-777-4232. Or visit us at MaryJaneMack.com.
Hi, I'm CJ Liu, and you're listening to Fired Up with CJ on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. This segment, our expert Dennis Hayes, who is one of the key contributors in making Earth Day one of the world's most widely observed secular holiday. This segment, we're going to be talking about a really cool, some really cool things that the Bullet Foundation is doing via a living building. So, Dennis, tell us, what is a living building?
It's a new approach to evaluating the way that buildings behave. There are a number of green certification efforts out there for buildings, some of them put together by Home Builders Association, the largest of them being the Green Building Council, which produces the LEED standards, and you can do a LEED certified, LEED silver, gold, or platinum building. And those consist of almost invariably a set of lists of things that you need to incorporate as features of your building, and the more of these features you incorporate, the higher the certification that you get. Mm-hmm. With the living building, it's very different. It's trying to not pay attention to whether your building has any given number of particular attributes, but how well it performs. So, for example, it needs to be net zero energy. The building itself needs to, and sometimes something called scale jump in some surrounding buildings, need to produce as much energy as it uses. Most commonly with solar photovoltaic cells, solar energy that produces electricity, and then run your building entirely on electricity and get as much off of your roof and your south wall and some surrounding structures as you use. That typically causes you to be super, super efficient. Part of it has to do with capturing all of the rain that falls on your roof and using that for your, if the law will allow it, for your drinking water and for all of your other water needs. You don't have any hookup to a sewage treatment facility. You have to treat your sewage on site. You have to have very high air quality inside. And all of these things are measured in performance. You actually see how many kilowatt hours you use, how many kilowatt hours you produce, and if those numbers don't add up, it doesn't make any difference how many panels you have on your roof. You have to get that net zero performance standard met. And it does have a few other things. You can have no toxic materials anywhere inside the building. You have to have a site that is responsibly chosen. If there is any part of the natural environment that is covered by your site, then you have to clear up some place and turn it into a natural environment that had previously been developed. What else? It's supposed to be an inspiring building so that when you walk by, it's graceful and beautiful to look at. But also inside, it's supposed to be a place that is a pleasure to work in. So there are features about how close you have to be to the nearest operable windows. The thought there being that it increases the well-being of the people in it. You have a healthier care and less disease, but also a higher productivity in your workforce. People actually want to come to this building during the day. It's an incredibly high set of standards. If I could, I could give you some numbers that might put this in context, CJ.
Sure, yeah.
The average commercial building today in Seattle has something called an EUI, an Energy Use Index. It's numbers of BTUs per square foot of interior space of about 92, 93, 94, somewhere in there. There was a brand new code that was adopted in Seattle within the last couple of years that a new building built to that code would drop significantly down into probably the high 70s, maybe 75, 76, 77. If you get a LEED certified building and you punch through to silver, to gold, to platinum, and you achieve platinum, and you get somebody who's operating the building really at its design optimum, you might get down to 32 or 33. Pretty big drop from 92. Then if you go to the most efficient building that's currently operating anywhere, certainly anywhere in the United States and possibly in the world, which is the new office building in Golden, Colorado for the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, it has an EUI, we believe it will after it's operated for a full year, it's only a few months old now, that looks like it'll be 22 or 23. And the building that we're putting up in Seattle will have an EUI, we believe, of about 16. So
Wow. It's
pushing energy efficiency just about as far as anybody today knows how to do it.
Wow, that is so cool. Okay, so tell us a little bit about the process of doing, I mean, the architects, how you're working it, how are you, I mean, these must be new challenges that people haven't really been thinking about, or they have and just thinking about a different way. How are you achieving this EUI of 16?
What we're doing is taking a bunch of things that have been done before but done individually and putting them all together in one structure. We brought in from the very, we had a series of meetings from a pretty diverse advisory group to sort of plumb all the different ideas that we could find out there. Then when we finally selected the architects, the engineers, and the general contractor out of a huge candidate pool, for all of our weekly meetings, now for more than a year, we've had representatives of the architecture firm, of the engineering firm, of the owner's reps, developers, and of the general contractors who will be building the building there from the very start, so that we didn't come up with something that looked really elegant but wasn't very practical to do. And we were looking at every aspect of every decision right from the ground floor up, coming up with what the profession calls an integrated building design, where everybody who's going to be involved in it has a role from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Much more commonly, the architects design a piece of sculpture and the engineers figure out what you can do to plummet and make it work halfway well, and then the contractors see how closely they can approximate that with real materials. And we've got all those different levels of idealism and pragmatism in it from the beginning. A couple of things that you might find interesting, just on the boundaries, after you've got your triple glazed operating windows, and these, you can't have windows that slide up and down or that crank open from one edge and yet have really airtight gaskets that endure over a long period of time. So we have windows that actually the entire window moves simultaneously away from the frame and then back to it, so that the pressure on the gaskets is constant at all times. And it has automatic shutters that are exterior shutters that go down when they ought to and go up when they ought to in terms of heating and daylighting, and also that can rotate to reflect sunlight up toward the roof of the building.
Oh, that's so cool. That's very cool.
We've got the entire roof covered with photovoltaic arrays. When
you walk into
this building to go to the commercial floors of it, you will be stepping into a light-filled sort of tube of an exterior stairway. Most stairwells are buried in the interior of buildings, and they're dark and dismal. This is something that will be light-filled and sort of draw you up. You can walk considerably further into the building and turn a couple of corners and find an elevator that sort of slowly will take you up to the top of the building. But we're trying to create a system where the natural thing to do is to walk up a few floors. It's going to be good for your personal health. It's going to be saving us energy. It's win-win.
It sounds amazing. So two questions before we close. One, how can we find out? Is there also a website for – I think I saw a website for the Living Building, but is there one in which we can look at the plans and take a look at how this building progresses?
Yes, there is. If you Google Living Building, you'll get to the International Living Building Institute, and you can find out everything about the Living Building Challenge. For our particular building, we are launching our website in about 3 weeks after we get past the next stage of the planning cycle with the City of Seattle for permitting the building. We're still making adjustments to what the final external appearance in particular will look like. You can always go to the Bullitt Foundation site, which is www.bullitt.org, and there will be a box there that you can click to take you to our building. So sometime between 3 weeks from now and 6 weeks from now, we'll have a pretty decent website up, and it will get better and better and better as time goes on, and we've got more and more data and more pictures of the construction and of all of the relevant characteristics of the building for people to. And among other things, for the toxics list, and this is really a challenge to find out all of these different things that go in a building that have no toxic materials in it, much of that is kept in a proprietary fashion by certain builders and architects and things. We're going to make all of ours sort of publicly accessible and
Man, you are leading the way again. I'm just astounded by all that you've accomplished in your life. That's pretty astounding. This building.
Well, all I've done is try to find the brightest possible people and cling to them as tightly as I can.
Please, you're amazing. All right, I want to thank you, Dennis, for sharing all that you've done for the world, and I'm just constantly amazed at all the wonderful things that you've done. Next Thursday on Fired Up with CJ, in the month of April, we'll be listening to other programs on the environment. Have a great week, and we'll see you next Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
You've been listening to Fire It Up with CJ. Tune in each week on Transformation Talk Radio at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time. For more of Fire It Up with CJ, it takes just one spark to ignite a fire. For dates and showtimes, visit www.fireitupwithcj.com or www.transformationtalkradio.com.